Ellen? You want to call people to order? You want me to call people to order? All right, we're going to start if everybody takes their seats. I would like to, I'm Bob Urim from Shepherd Mullin Richter and Hampton Law Firm in San Francisco. I'm pleased to be here to chair the afternoon panel, which everyone is dying to see and participate in. So if the folks in the back could come sit down, that would be great. So I'd like to start off by explaining the purpose and the format of the panel. As folks can see up here, we've got nine panelists. When Ellen asked me to chair the panel, I wasn't sure whether she wanted me to be the moderator or the manager of a baseball team, but hopefully we'll do both. We're going to try and keep the panel on discussion, on point. I'll have some assistance at various times during the presentation for the speakers. I promise them that when their time is up, there'll be a bell to ring to keep everyone on schedule. The goal of this panel, many of you may know, the Bay Planning Coalition has been working on a waterfront leadership initiative where the goal is to have the Bay Planning Coalition play a positive role in change in the waterfront. So the goal of the panel, which is to bring to address the future of the waterfront and contiguous lands, and particularly to provide feedback to the Bay Planning Coalition for its leadership initiative. So there's a challenging vision. It's described in the program. We have nine panelists. The format we've decided upon for this panel is three rounds of speaking for each of the panelists. They're going to start off in the first panelist, 5 to 6 minutes, talk about the waterfront, what their role is, what their needs are, what their goals in that, sort of as an introduction to each of the panelists. Then we're going to have a second round of questions. They're going to take about 5 to 6 minutes for each of them for that. Then we're going to have a second round about what they see as the obstacles to accomplishing their goals and their specific recommendations for the Bay Planning Coalition and others to accomplish that. And then the third round of questions is going to be questions between the panelists to each other. And so this is a chance for them to have interaction with the three panelists. And the first speaker is going to be John Gioia. John is only going to be with us for his presentation, but please join me in welcoming him and thanking him for taking time in his very busy schedule.
Thank you. Thanks. The good news is you only get to hear from me once, and for a few minutes. I'm actually heading off to the brand new San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority, which meets actually in about 3 minutes, a few blocks away. So I wanted to say a few words just from the perspective of somebody in local government. I've been on the Board of Supervisors in Contra Costa County now for about 10 years. I have also served on BCDC for about 10 years. I'm on the Air District as well as the ABAG board. And prior to that was on the East Bay Mud Board. So I sort of look at things from a regional perspective. And I also happen to live at the waterfront. I live actually at a waterfront community in Richmond, a formerly industrial part of Richmond that now has a mix between residential and industrial. So what I wanted to offer, and you have a great panel with great speakers, is just a few thoughts about how we all think about moving forward in planning for the waterfront. You know, I think there are so many stresses on the waterfront here in the Bay Area, and there's going to frankly be so much expected of the waterfront. You know, the coexistence of industry with residential communities, with public access, with ferry terminals. So there's going to be a lot of stress on the waterfront. And I think it can occur in a good way as long as there's a very good and thorough public process that involves all the stakeholders when we go forward with planning the waterfront. You know, the community I live in Richmond has seen, you know, sometimes conflict and sometimes cooperation between industry and residential and public access uses. And ultimately, a lot of the regional policies that we're seeing in the Bay Area look to possibly put more housing near the waterfront as we see more industrial land being converted over to residential, but also understanding that there are still a lot of industrial uses that depend on the waterfront, like the oil refineries. So how do you have a coexistence? And then, of course, the ports. So my observation in all of this is that we're most successful in having a good planning process along the waterfront if we very early bring together all the stakeholders, bringing together the existing property owners and along the waterfront, oftentimes industry. We bring together local neighborhood associations. We bring local government in that picture, and frankly, I think involve the regional agencies. You know, again, referring to the context of my own community where you have a planned ferry terminal along the waterfront, we saw sometimes conflict between building new housing to support housing around transit, right? Transit-oriented development, a very positive objective that we want to see, in this case also to support ferry service. And then you have existing port and industrial uses. So that's a conflict. And how do you look at buffer zones between industry and housing? So my really short comment is that I think it's possible to accommodate the right amount of public access and preserving some open space, clearly along the shoreline, because it's a very, very valuable asset. Once it's gone, it's gone, while preserving the industry that may need to exist along the waterfront, and to head off those conflicts very early on. Because I think the longer you go down a road without involving all the stakeholders and entering into conflict, the much harder it will be to reach resolution. You know, ABAG has established what they call sort of priority development zones. And some of these, again, may be near waterfront to take advantage of ferry transportation. And yet that puts stress on sort of the natural habitat along the bay, as well as conflicts with industry. And now you have this newly formed San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority that's going to look at how do we improve the sort of the wetland, improve wetlands around the bay, and preserving parts of shoreline really as open to access and open space. So those are my brief comments, and I know the speakers are going to probably talk more specifically about how each of those come into play. But I strongly believe that we have to listen to each, and sometimes the initial, I mean, I've walked into a process, you know, obviously believing in many cases highest and best use along a waterfront is residential and public access because of the value that brings, but I've also come to be respectful of the role that industry plays and how important it may depend on the waterfront as well. And of course, the need to preserve port capacity. And I know you're going to be taking questions later. If you want to have one question or two before I head off to this restoration authority, I'm willing to take it and so, may not.
John, one of the questions we'd like you to address is what do you see as the role of the Bay Planning Coalition as you grapple with the issues? You know, what obstacles do you see, and how can the Bay Planning Coalition be helpful to you and your interests?
I think the Bay Planning Coalition can be useful in trying to bring together, obviously, you know, its membership of business and industry and some public agencies with a unified voice, knowing that every community along the waterfront has different issues, right? You know, the issues in Richmond or Redwood City or Vallejo and San Francisco are all very different. But I think it's often useful to try to get a single voice, but also, I mean, to have your members understand while they've been around on the Bay for a long time, there are new competing uses, and that sometimes having these new uses can be done in such a way that doesn't necessarily threaten the existence of an existing business or industry. I think that's really important because I understand the very first reaction an industry is going to have is, gee, this new use is going to threaten, you know, my existence and people are going to complain. So I think it's possible to have that coexistence, but and working through organizations like Bay Planning may make that easier.
Good, and I'll just have one more quick question. Will Travis suggested the other panelists address this issue about what are your thoughts about the approach for dealing with a vacant, low-lying property that currently isn't in danger of flooding, but may be inundated by sea level in the not-too-distant future?
And I'm sure that, you know, Will Travis is going to talk more about that because BCDC, I think, is really the one agency in the Bay Area that has really been focusing on the impacts of climate change along the shoreline. I look out every day from my house, glad that the water level at the bay is many feet below the level of my backyard. But I think that's clearly a planning issue that's going to have to come into play. That as local government, we're looking, for example, at some, you know, specific plan issues in the North Richmond area, some land use planning issues, and I think that's an issue we're going to have to think about because there are some low-lying areas, and we need to think early. It doesn't make sense to plan and then plan communities where there may where there's going to be sea level rise that's going to jeopardize those communities, and they have to spend a tremendous amount of money later on to address the issues of sea level rise, that we have to think about that now, and I think local governments are beginning to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will?
Well, I didn't know about this three rounds business because I'm going to speak for a few minutes and then that will exhaust all my knowledge. So don't worry about asking questions or any follow-up. Having spent 38 years working for California state coastal management agencies, I have some passing familiarity with waterfront issues and needs and roles. Suffice it to say, they are many, complex, conflicting, and quite interesting. Around the bay, and in fact around the nation, waterfronts are inherently dangerous places. They get battered by storms, coastal properties erode and fall into the sea. Reclaimed land around the bay may liquefy during an earthquake. Waterfront properties sometimes contain toxic materials left by earlier users. Some current industrial port, military, and transportation operations themselves are dangerous to be around. And as the maps I hope we've distributed today show, many waterfront areas around the bay are vulnerable to flooding from sea level rise. Now, having said that, much of our nation's population seems absolutely intent in moving from the center heartland of our country to these dangerous coastal locations. Half of the population of the United States already lives within 50 miles of the coast. Industrial waterfronts are being transformed into upscale mixed-use developments. Barrier islands are becoming lock gate communities. And old fishing villages have become chic tourist meccas. The waterfront of San Francisco Bay faces these same issues. And over the past few months, under Ellen's leadership, our staff has been meeting with members of your coalition to gain a better understanding of this issue and to try to figure out what to do about it. We've learned that residential developers have often taken advantage of lower land costs and have responded to the call for more infill development by purchasing underused waterfront properties, building condos and apartments, which are then occupied by residents who often complain about the noise and the dirt from their neighboring industrial users. Industries need a place for waterfront space. They need it to receive or ship products by water, or they provide goods movement services. They believe they're being displaced by uses that don't really need a waterfront location. Yet these non-water dependent uses, be they hotels, restaurants, housing, or offices, want to be on the waterfront because there is a big economic competitive advantage when renting a room, serving a meal, selling a house, or occupying an office that has a bayfront location. Now we have these advocates for each of these uses of a particular waterfront space, and each one advances his self-interests cloaked in the robes of lofty public policy objectives or a high moral imperative, be it generating much-needed revenue for local government, creating new jobs, increasing the region's housing supply, moving goods that help our economy prosper, or protecting an endangered species or the rights of the public to have access to the bay. Deciding who should determine how the waterfront should be used and how these determinations should be made is a vexing problem. Some would leave it to the marketplace to decide what's the highest and best use of a waterfront property. In other words, they say, follow the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. Now, clearly, there are shortcomings with this approach. Local governments have the most sweeping authority over land use through zoning and building restrictions. But some don't think that local governments alone can adequately protect regional, state, and national interests. And that's why for 40 years, BCDC has had the authority to designate and protect priority use areas along the waterfront for ports, airports, water-related industries, and other uses that advance state objectives. Now, clearly, BCDC's authority could be expanded to deal with a broader range of waterfront land use conflicts. In deciding whether the Bay Planning Coalition would consider supporting expanding BCDC's authority, I'm reminded of a comment that Congressman Gary Studs made after he chaired a series of committee oversight hearings on the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act. And one of the main issues his committee was grappling with was which level of government, federal, state, or local, should be empowered to make the fundamental decisions on coastal management. Mr. Studs said that he was convinced that after listening to all of the testimony, everybody agreed on one thing. The agency of government that is best, the best one to make any particular decision, is that agency that will give you the answer that you want. Well, over the next few years, BCDC will be updating our regional seaport, airport, water-related industry designations to reflect the best information available on how much waterfront space we need for these uses. But more immediately, we're in the process of updating our Bay Plan to acknowledge that vast shoreline areas are in danger over the next few decades of being inundated from sea level rise and increased storm surges caused by climate change. Our report documents that downtown San Francisco and Oakland International Airports, many shoreline neighborhoods, commercial areas, and ports are vulnerable to flooding. On May 7th, we are holding a public hearing on the proposed changes to the Bay Plan to address these issues. I urge you to closely review our staff report on which these plan changes are based, because the current debate over whether a particular shoreline property should be used for gravel storage, a restaurant, condominiums, or a park becomes far more complex if the park or the property is likely to be flooded in the future, in which case we will have to decide whether preventing the flooding is possible, and if so, how, and who will pay for the flood protection, and if not, whether the property owner should be compensated. In short, climate change will make everything we did in the past far more complex in the future and is forcing us to think about everything we do in all new ways. Thank you for having me here today.
Okay, Mark Christian. Thanks, Will. That was great. I had to ring the bell. I let him finish, but I wanted to show I had the power. So
it shows how simple it is to take power away. I'm Mark Grisham. I'm the city manager of Pittsburgh, and I actually sometimes wear two hats when I talk about waterfront development. One is I actually own 8 acres on Upper San Pablo Bay. And every time I try to figure out what I'm going to do with my property, and then I count the 11 agencies that all have 11 different ideas of what I should do with my property, I like the compensation idea, though. That's starting to sound more and more attractive. I realize that making decisions in the Bay Area is very difficult. But the hat I'm wearing today is as city manager of Pittsburgh, and I want to talk a little bit about our port and also about industrial development in the Bay Area. Increasingly, as I listen, what I hear is we're going to have a world of condominiums and cappuccino bars. And this first came to my attention when I was at a presentation, and a major planner, who will go unnamed, in the Bay Area, was talking about the future of development, and he stated that heavy industrial development is dead in California, and there's no future. So I thought, I better call him up and talk with him about my city. And I did, and I explained what we were doing. And he said, yeah, but that's not the future. Well, that was about 3 years ago. And currently, I have one project completed, industrial, with a value of $200 million. I have one new 300,000 square foot project called Spiral Pipe, which has a value of $180 million. And I have one new project in the planning phases, which within 2 years will have a value of $100 million. And I said to myself, that's almost a half a billion dollars of investment in my community, and it's all heavy industry. And because we believe there's a strong role for heavy industry within the Bay Area, and it's an industry that many times has to be on the waterfront, it should be protected and it should be nurtured. And that's not to say we're against condominium development or marinas and all that. We have those things. But we realize that a waterfront community should be a balanced community, because you can't buy a condo if you don't have a job. And so we look at this and this focus, and we think that's very important. But another thing we got into was interacting with our sister cities. Our sister cities are Wenzhou in China, Shimonoseki in Japan, and Pohang in Korea. All three of them have major industrial port development underway or completed, because they, as communities, see a major focus in maritime development within the Pacific Rim. And we think that's something we should remember and be a part of. And it was interesting, I was in Shanghai, and I was at Sinochem, who's one of our trading partners. They buy something from California, which is always nice. They buy petroleum coke, and they ship it to China. And Madam Zhou, who heads up their petroleum operation, she looks at me and she goes, well, Mark, what's going on with the dredging in the Baldwin Ship Channel? And she proceeds to grill me on the Baldwin Ship Channel. And I'm going, what's the Baldwin Ship Channel? Okay, how come she knows more about San Francisco Bay than I do? And what are her concerns? Well, her concerns are very simple. When she sends a ship to the Bay Area for petroleum coke, and it gets to the Pinole Shores up by Vallejo, one of the things we find out very quickly is that you really don't want to have that ship much deeper than about 30 feet. Okay, because if you think Panamax ships are what we use, they're about, I think, 70,000 tons worth of cargo. When they come in to either take cargo, bring steel in, or take petroleum out, we can only load to 60 or 70% of capacity because of the dredging issues. And that's something I think we have to be very concerned about, is how we are able to move cargoes in and out. And it gets into a lot of issues. If you don't have depth, you've got concerns about grounding. And I think all of us know we don't want any ship to ground. If you don't have the right width for your channel, then you're looking at issues of ship interaction. And the last thing we want is two ships to decide they're going to meet in the night. And one-way traffic is not efficient. And of course, if we think about traffic issues and air quality, when I have to bring more Panamax ships up to my port, that means that there's more air pollution and there's more chances for contact. And so one of the things that we're looking to do, and there's a new group, actually, which is the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee, and it's dealing with these issues and how we deal with dredging, how we deal with safety issues, because I heard discussions about Stockton. Well, if you think I had problems because my control depth should be 35 feet, and on a good day, the best I can get is 31 feet, think of Stockton. Think of Sacramento. And I like the idea of barges. I heard that discussed. But if I had a choice between barges and actually bringing a seagoing ship up and only handling a loading operation once, I think my choice would be seagoing ship, loading operation only once, because that's more energy efficient, it's more air quality efficient. So in Pittsburgh, I never thought I would have a port to manage, but I do, and I realize there is a place for industry, and industry can be a growth business for your city if it's a situation where you manage it properly and you get it to interact with your other uses. Thank you.
Thank you. Terrific. Okay, Susan McHugh from Vallejo. Thank you. It's a great story.
Good afternoon. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm the Economic Development Manager of Vallejo, so of course you'll accuse me of having a development bias, and you'd be correct. I'm also wanted to let you know that we're handing out a four-page handout, and probably if you'd be most interested in the cover, which is really a synopsis of the waterfront project, which is what I wanted to talk about today, or at least until the bell rings. Vallejo has a really wonderful opportunity to redevelop 92 linear acres. And as you'll see on the map handout, these 92 linear acres are anchored in the center by a wonderful ferry, and it's a great ferry ride to San Francisco. If you've never done it, I highly recommend it. It's a wonderful system. On the top of your map, you'll see what is Mare Island. And I'm sure you're all familiar with our former Navy base, which was closed in about the 95 round of base closures. And we're working very closely with Lennar, our master developer, to do, again, a wonderful mix of industrial, residential, and commercial on Mare Island. But getting back to our 92 acres, you'll see there's a southern, a northern, and a central piece. The next sheet, and I won't read any of this to you, you can read along. Of these 92 acres, there's a really dynamic mix of commercial opportunities, 35 acres of open space and parks and promenades, a lot of residential. I think if I could just summarize it in a sentence, really, I think Vallejo is on a good path with this blueprint to take advantage of these 92 acres with a smarter, more dense development, and we're really moving to our next evolution. You can look back 50 years and see that we always had a mixed-use waterfront. This is just going to be a slightly different mix. And I think to echo Mark and some of the goals that the city of Pittsburgh has, again, city of Vallejo, as you all can imagine, is extremely motivated on the revenue front and to create new jobs. And many of our employees and folks that live in town do have industrial skills, and so we're extremely interested in using both Mare Island and our waterfront to take advantage of those boat building and other kinds of skills that our folks have. Let me see if there's anything else. I think I was going to talk a little bit about roles. 92 acres is a public-private partnership of the redevelopment agency. Joe Callahan and De Silva as our master developer and the city. And let me briefly describe what we're each bringing to the table. The city is going to be building a $100 million downtown transit hub, which consists of a 1,200-acre parking structure, which will service the ferry riders, and a bus transit facility in the downtown. The redevelopment agency is responsible for much of the public infrastructure and for doing clearing much of this land and leading to the parcels needed for development. Callahan De Silva has been a very patient and wonderful partner. They have been working on this project since the year 2000 and continue to hang in there with us. So this is our blueprint, and we're following it, and I hope you come happy to give you a tour of our project, either Mare Island or the Waterfront Project, and look forward to talking about it as we go forward. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Susan. So, Tom Ward, please, Ward's America.
I've been graciously permitted one slide to show you, and that's because as an engineer, to be able to talk without a picture is not possible. Ports America, effective next January 1st, will be a new tenant for the Port of Oakland. We'll be taking over a complex known as the Outer Harbor Complex, 165 acres of existing marine container terminal with 3,000 feet of linear wharf in front of it. Our goal in taking over this facility for the next 50 years as a cold lease is to substantially augment its capacity while at the same time reducing its environmental footprint and increasing its effectiveness in terms of efficiency. What you see here is a graphic rendering of a high-density container yard system known as a stacking crane system. The existing facility is good for about 5,000 20-foot containers per year for every gross acre. This system will triple that, so we will be making three times as good a use of the existing land footprint as is currently possible with existing technology. That yard full of cranes, those cranes are all electric. They are all regenerative electric, so when they hoist, they use power. When they lower a load, they generate power. Those cranes will be semi-robotic. Because they are semi-robotic, they do not need open field lighting for the marine terminal. The terminal will operate in the dark. The being semi-robotic cranes, they will know where the ground is. They have exquisite load control, so the noise pollution that's inherent in container operations will be largely eliminated. We also won't have all the warning bells that you hear when you get close to one of our facilities. We'll have a high-speed gate that minimizes truck wait time. When trucks come into the terminal, they will park and wait for their loads with their engines off. We will be substantially reducing by more than 50% the number of diesel engines required to move containers between the waterfront edge of the facility and the waterside edge of the container yard itself. It's a little bit hard to see. The port has a plan for building a rail yard on the Oakland Army Base property called OHIT. We are eager to see that happen. We aren't sure when it's going to happen, but we're eager to see it happen. If that facility is built, we have a concept for offering diesel-free transfer of containers between our marine terminal and that rail yard directly across Maritime Street. We believe that this is a vision for a facility that makes better use of land, has a substantially smaller carbon footprint than the existing facilities, offers a more efficient operation in terms of expense per lift, and offers a continuation of the growth of the Port of Oakland as an important economic engine for the Bay region and as a force for global trade and the benefits and peace that it brings to all of us. So this is our goal as a private developer. The port's lease structure for this facility is different. It's called a public-private partnership, but in effect, it's kind of a cold lease. They're handing the terminal over to us for a wad of cash, and all of the capital and development that you see there, all the cranes, all the infrastructure, everything will be done by Ports America. Our budget for developing this facility, if the economy ever recovers, is about $650 million of private development. So this is our stake in Oakland, and this is our intent to make the most of an existing facility without having to build any more additional land space for the port. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. And this is a very exciting panel. I think that's just terrific things. Paul Campos, you're hiding, Paul?
One moment. I found my way.
He's General Counsel of the Home Builders Association of Northern California.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Bay Planning Coalition, for inviting me to speak. I've been involved with Bay Planning for many years, and I've always thoroughly respected and enjoyed that relationship. I think I'm on this panel to be the human embodiment of waterfront condos and Starbucks. But not to get too personal, but I happen to live in something even worse, which is a single-family detached house in Danville. And I like it, and I go to Pete's. I do walk there quite a bit. I'm going to start off with reading from a piece that was in yesterday's New York Times, and it's somewhat provocative, I think, for those of us in the Bay Area, and it doesn't necessarily reflect my views, and in fact, my remarks after I read from this don't necessarily reflect my views, so I'll leave it to, you'll have to decide later, or you'll have to ask me later what I actually do mean. So this is from Ed Glaser, who's a very prolific and prominent economics professor at Harvard. And he had this to say. Can environmentalism be bad for the environment? In my own field of housing, a similar phenomenon occurs when some environmental groups put their own local interests ahead of global warming. Homes in coastal California use much less energy than homes in other places in the country. New building in California, as opposed to Texas, reduces America's carbon emissions. Yet instead of fighting to make it easier to build in California, environmentalists have played a significant role stemming the growth of America's greenest cities. San Francisco is the greenest metropolitan area in the country. An average new home there emits about 38,000 pounds of carbon dioxide each year. Houston is the brownest area in the country. An average new home there emits about 68,000 pounds of carbon dioxide each year. California owns our top five list of greenest metropolitan areas in our sample, which includes San Jose, San Diego, even Los Angeles, and Sacramento. Why are these California areas so green? The primary reason is climate. So environmentalists should, presumably, be out there lobbying for more homes in coastal California. But instead, for more than four decades, California environmental groups, and then he then actually names one, which I'm not going to, but their initials are STB, have fought new construction in the most temperate, lowest carbon emission area of the country. This anti-growth movement has achieved enormous success, and the growth rate of California has plummeted. In the last 20 years that ended in 1970, California's population increased by 88%. Between 2000 and 2007, the population of California grew by less than 8%, which is slightly more than the growth of the United States population. California's low growth doesn't reflect lack of demand. Prices remain quite high, at least they did, or lack of land, in his words, density or low, but instead one of the most regulated building environments in the country. And he ends his piece by saying, Earth Day is a great occasion to think about the environment. However, good environmentalism requires recognizing that a little less green in some places may actually be good for the planet, and that sometimes acting locally is bad for the globe. So, an interesting piece from Professor Glaser, and sort of frames the context and the theme that I want to talk briefly about, and it relates to sustainability, and my association, the Home Builders Association of Northern California, is a strong proponent of sustainable development and issues. We were the first home builders association in the country to endorse an independent third-party green building mandate, the locally based Build It Green, Green Point rated program. And we were also strong supporters and negotiators in Senate Bill 375, making that a reality, which has as its goal changing land use patterns to reduce auto dependency and thereby reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So sustainability is something that we're familiar with and support. The question and some thoughts that I'd like to leave today have to do with sustainability of a different kind, and that is our regulatory regime, particularly with respect to housing here in the Bay Area, is it sustainable? Most, if not all, but certainly most of the regulations that we see today on housing As the gentleman from Pittsburgh noted, when looking at his 8 acres, there are at least 11 and probably double that regulatory agencies, each with their own individual mandate to protect a resource or to impose a regulation on a new housing project. And again, most of those were crafted during what I think is going to turn out to be an historic bubble. And so we have fees and exactions and requirements and restrictions imposed on new housing that are all today premised on a median house price in the San Francisco Bay Area of about $600,000. Well, today the median house price is about $300,000. And I don't know anyone in the industry or in the economics profession who thinks it's going to be back up to $600,000 anytime soon. And it's those median house prices of existing housing that are the direct competitors for new housing. So in other words, that's our market. We're going to have to start building new housing in the Bay Area that costs, for sale, $300,000. Now, in some communities, the fees that jurisdictions impose, just local city and school fees, are about $150,000. And then when you figure into land and labor and materials and other costs, you quickly get over $300,000 quite easily. And so there's a very real conundrum there where we have a system and we've built up a series of expectations that we expect from the proponent of a new housing project in terms of providing amenities or designing projects or avoiding this or paying a fee for that, that is premised again on that $600,000 median home price Bay Area figure. And so there's, I think, going to have to be a recalibrating of our system, how we look at housing, where it should go, how it should be permitted, who should make the decisions. Do we need to have some sort of cumulative impact analysis for housing? Say, okay, we've got only so much new regulation can be imposed on any particular project, and you agencies go figure it out how you want to spend those mitigation dollars. So that's those are some thoughts. One thing I do want to end with of some change that I see a blowing in the wind or whatever it's called is the California Attorney General has, as we all know, been very active in filing lawsuits and comments on local growth plans, generally greenfield development based on greenhouse gas emissions issues. They are now starting to consider downtown growth restrictions, growth controls, growth caps. They are actively considering going after the city of Pleasanton right now, which has an absolute build-out cap. And so to me, that was always the inevitable direction, is if we're going to restrict and limit and put requirements on housing in one place, we've got to make it easier to build at least somewhere. Thank you.
In the interest of Attorney General's gubernatorial campaign, I thought I would save him there. So, and Nina Reynolds, the executive director of WTEA. Thank you, Paul.
Sorry. Good afternoon. My name is Nina Reynolds, and I am the executive director of the Water Emergency Transportation Authority here in the San Francisco Bay Area. A whole month and a half new to the position. I wanted to speak very briefly about who we are and what we're doing and how we sort of fit in on this panel in my mind here. I don't know how many folks have heard of us here in the room today, but we are through some late night makeover legislation that went into effect in January 2008. We are the agency responsible for planning and implementing new ferry service on the bay, and also we have some new charges as of January, including working with the cities of Vallejo and Alameda to take over their city-based ferry transit services and create this regional system. And also to serve as the coordinator of emergency services, ferry transportation services on the bay. We are, At this point in time, we've worked for the last year to develop two state-mandated plans to look at how do we deliver what it is that we've been charged with doing. And we've just released those plans this month and held public hearings for input on those plans. One is a transition plan that looks at the next 5 years. It's effectively a business plan, in my view. It looks at how are you going to actually achieve this consolidation of the city services under your umbrella, and also continue the original charge that our previous agency, the Water Transit Authority, was charged with of also expanding ferry services on the bay. So what is it going to look like when you become this regional organization? You have a limited pot of funds. What will your new services look like, and how can you deliver them? So it's a five-year financially constrained plan that looks at what our regional system will look like in the future. We've also developed this emergency response plan that takes a look at how we would operate, what our responsibilities would be, et cetera, in the event that there is a disaster or an emergency that impacts our transportation infrastructure here in San Francisco. A few key points that have come out in the development of these plans that I'd like to bring to your attention. What we're looking to do is take over the city-based services January 2010. And one of the things in talking with the cities that's become so apparent is that regardless of who's operating the services, that we need to work together in the future. One of our previous panelists spoke to the redevelopment plans for downtown Vallejo. They are vital to the ferry transit services, and I think ferry transit services are vital to the city's plans. So no matter who's operating the services, waterfront properties, partnerships with the cities and counties and various owners and custodians of waterfront are critically important to future ferry transportation services. Our plan identifies dates that we hope to achieve for expanding services. There are three services in particular that over the next 5 years we hope to see implemented, and that includes a new ferry service from the East Bay to South San Francisco biotech industrial area, a service between Berkeley and San Francisco, for which we're in the process of developing an environmental plan for. And also we're working closely as a partner with the City of San Francisco in their plans for redeveloping Treasure Island and implementing ferry service as a part of that whole development. I think the third component of our plans that are critical that we've identified is obviously what does it take to be able to respond in an emergency? What are those assets that are needed, access to water, floats, terminals, facilities in order to support emergency response ferry services. And we've identified the need to look at developing both an operations and maintenance facility up in the Vallejo area on Mare Island, as well as a Central Bay facility as well. Very briefly, that's what our plans for the future are, and I think I just wanted to touch on, you know, how do we fit in here? And I think, you know, the bottom line is we don't set regulations, we don't own property, we rely very strongly upon partnerships with the cities and with our other local government agencies in order to do what we do. Public transit does not create a profit. So one of our challenges is to figure out how to add benefit to the developments and to other folks' plans for their development of their areas, which is, of course, filled with challenges. But I look forward to working with several folks here on the panel in the future to achieve our plans. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker will be Beth Huning, who's coordinator for the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture.
I want to thank the Bay Planning Coalition for the invitation to be part of this panel. I'm also representing another partnership organization, and the Bay Planning Coalition, I am pleased to inform you, if you don't know, you're a member of our partnership. What I'm here to do today is to speak for a different set of constituents and different uses of the waterfront as compared to those that you've already heard from. And what we do is we represent the organizations, agencies, and the business communities that have interests in helping to protect, restore, and enhance the quality of wetlands around San Francisco Bay. So what we are actually is a federally chartered program that was developed under the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, but is now operated by the Fish and Wildlife Service to implement all of the federal bird conservation plans on a continental scale. So we're part of a program that is continental-wide, not just for waterfowl, but all of the different species that inhabit the wetlands. And in San Francisco Bay, when we developed our implementation plan, we were really looking at not only being all bird, but also to restore ecological functions and values of wetlands in San Francisco Bay. And wetlands have huge economic benefits. I wish I would have taken the time to go back and do the reread the analysis that we did for the economic stimulus package, but it was in the billions and billions of dollars. And because of the flood control values as well as the ability to act like the lungs of the bay and absorb high rising tides during global warming, as well as protecting areas for wildlife that use the bay, our other residents here, so not only threatened and endangered species, but also the 45% of the diving ducks that winter from the entire lower Pacific flyway here in the bay, and in some instances, entire populations of shorebirds. And consequently, these wetlands not only have huge values for the wildlife and the economic values accordingly because of the infrastructure that they produce, but also they really do give us the quality of life that we enjoy here on the bay. So I'm really here to share with you some of those values and a little bit about how we go about doing our goals. Back in 2001, our implementation plan was adopted federally, and it included a lot of the work that was done on the Habitat Goals Project. What we did was take that information that was put together by the Habitat Goals Project, segment it by different focal areas in the bay, and then also work up the watershed a little bit to identify particular projects that could meet the various goals that were outlined in the Habitat Goals Projects, not only for baylands, tidal wetlands, diked marsh, seasonal wetlands, riparian habitats, and then to be able to translate that into how it would function on the ground. So our partnership is strictly non-regulatory. What we are doing is working with landowners on a voluntary basis, either to protect their property, but more recently we've shifted our focus to the restoration of those properties that we've protected. Not that we're out of the protection business, because there are still some key parcels along the North Richmond shoreline in San Pablo Bay and in other parts of our territory that have still potential for either working with existing landowners or through the planning process or through outright protection in order to secure wetlands and particularly also the adjacent uplands that buffer them. Because of climate change and global warming, as Travis was mentioning, these wetlands are even more critically important. We feel that if we can accomplish the 12 largest projects in the bay and then provide where we can some additional areas for them to migrate for climate change and global warming, this will be a lot cheaper in the long run than trying to build levees and trying to ensure that they are shored up in order to protect the infrastructure. Although we realize that here we are in one of the most urbanized estuaries anywhere, and our projects really need to take into account the fact that we have infrastructure in every single one of them, whether it is protecting areas that are already developed or and building levees accordingly, such as what is happening with the South Bay Restoration Plan and the South Bay Shoreline Studies, or, for example, in the North Bay, where they've had to shore up PG&E power poles. In fact, PG&E sits on our board as well because of the fact that every one of these projects has infrastructure crossing them. So we're not going to be able to bring back the bay the way that it was originally structured. We're looking at reconnecting hydrologies and trying to bring back ecological functions and maintain and, where we can, increase wildlife and open space values. So I also wanted to kind of share with you some of the roles that the Bay Planning Coalition has played in the past in some of these projects. The Port of Oakland dredge materials have been a major element in recreating the wetlands at Hamilton. And although there probably will not be enough sediment from that port project to complete that project, it's gotten it very well down the way of restoring it, that huge property in San Pablo Bay. Bear Island and the Port of Redwood City was another reuse of dredge materials. And so what we are doing is looking at all types of partners to get these projects done. And the Bay Planning Coalition is an important partner in a number of these projects. Some of our highest priorities I mentioned of the 12 largest projects, to get some of these projects moving again. We've been under a state bond freeze now. The voters of the Bay Area really were the ones that passed a lot of the bonds that have allowed these projects to go forward. And consequently, we've had a vote to be able to say that the citizens of the Bay Area want to maintain open spaces along the waterfront. They want the protection that these wetlands create for floods and also the wildlife values that they support. But the projects have been, under the last 6 months, under a stop work order and a bond freeze, and consequently, a lot of them have just come to a grinding halt. What this has done is also give us the opportunity to get creative and try to find other funding sources and other ways of funding them. And we just did find out this morning that this big obstacle to getting these projects moving has been lifted, so that bond freeze was lifted by the governor this morning, which we're very happy about. One of the things that we do try to do is work directly through our partner organizations. We have a very small staff. It's the partners that are getting these projects done, and so they're going to be trying to re-gear and pick up these projects again. So what I wanted to do is to leave you with the thought that these projects cost a lot of money, but when I hear the costs of a number of these others and the projects, as well as when you think of the expense of trying to protect against climate change and flood control, what we want to try to do is to work collaboratively to protect wetlands where we can, restore them where they're at all feasible, and to try to secure, through the planning process and working with landowners, the ability to protect adjacent uplands and allow them to migrate wherever possible. So thank you.
And the last speaker in the first round will be Boris Dramov from Roma Design. Boris?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I think the Bay Planning Coalition is the answer. It brings everything together. So, no, I think if you hear the diversity of the speakers in this forum, you know, to me today is how do we bring all of these different points of view and not always end up in the confrontation between the different values. And I think that is an essential part of what needs to happen. You know, the Bay is one of the most wonderful resources in this region. It certainly gives us the meaning and identity. I think Ron Blattman is here, who put together a great documentary on Saving the Bay, which will be, you know, viewed soon. And, you know, if we look at it, it needs to serve all of those functions. You know, there were speakers here who talked about the transportation industry and the ports, and certainly that's an essential component. Waterborne transit is essential and is certainly underutilized for the potential that can happen here in the Bay. The importance of wetlands restoration and the ecological and environmental value, absolutely an essential component, too. But it is also a great place to live. And in fact, I think the New York Times article was not terribly off base because our moderate climate on the Bay and because it has the value that people want, is also very desirable. And it is also the area of greatest change. In any region, the bays or the waterfront edge is the greatest change. It's greatest change geomorphologically and in our civilization. That is where the majority of the change happens. There have been misuses of the bay, clearly over time, you know, dumping, filling, putting the transportation facilities that have cut us off from the bay. You know, those are things that, you know, many of which through the efforts of organizations like BCDC have really been brought into much greater control and thought. But to me, in where I come from is I've been involved in planning on waterfront areas now for over 30 years. I think in the Bay Area, it began with the downtown waterfront. I've worked in Suisun, small community. We're currently working in Redwood City on the Saltworks project, which is a very large project. And, you know, there are a couple of things I have found that are common. You know, to me, there is today, as maybe in the past, there was a need to really take and look at what was happening more comprehensively and what started with, you know, Save the Bay and ended up with the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. When I look at it today, the forces of anti-growth, the NIMBYism, the small-mindedness, the coalition of the negative is what I call, is so much prevalent in today. And it's so much more difficult to bring about the coalition of the positive. You know, where are the advocate groups for positive change in this environment? Where are the groups that say change needs to happen? Let's get positive change to happen. We're not going to do things in a way that harm the environment. We're not going to only do things that are in terms of growth and development. And it's a very difficult thing to occur, it takes a great deal of leadership. I remember when we were working in 1979 and we started on the San Francisco waterfront, San Francisco had spent a lot of time saying about what shouldn't happen on the waterfront. Don't do this, don't do that. And finally, Dianne Feinstein and George Moscone said, well, let's put together a group of environmentalists. BCDC was on it, planning agencies were on it in the city. Let's figure out what we can do. You know, we've got all this growth. We've stopped growth in the neighborhoods. We've stopped filling. We've stopped all this. But tell us what positive things you can do. And out of that came the Northeast Waterfront Plan and the change that we see today on the San Francisco waterfront. Point of that is that it only happens if the leadership is there to say, look, bring all these values together and then figure out a way in which positive change can occur. If we hadn't done the housing near downtown, which is part of South Beach, and then led to Mission Bay, where would we be today? We'd be pushing all the housing out of the region. And San Francisco has done a lot to encourage the economic well-being. Now, in terms of the kinds of things that need to be addressed, I have to point to some of the things that we're involved with in Redwood City as well on the Saltworks, this 1,400-acre piece of property. One of the first things that has come about is that half of it will go to open space and restoration. I think that kind of balanced approach is essential. There is a port there. It's a bulk port of Redwood City. It has to fit in with what they want to do and what they're going to continue to do in that area. We have a city that has been really divided from the Bay, so we have to help overcome the barrier of 101, all of those other elements that divide the city and the waterfront. Those are typical things that every city has to do because we can't help it. We need to do that. And we need to create a better job housing balance in the Bay Area, and fortunately, there is an opportunity to do that as well, bring housing closer to jobs and to do that, and to support the transit system, the potential of putting a ferry terminal there, creating a streetcar system that might link Caltrain to the ferries and to future development. I'm just giving examples of that, not to specifically point that out, but there are a multitude of elements that have to be brought together. And today, because of sea level rise, a comprehensive regional approach that thinks of positive change is essential, and I look to agencies like BCDC to take a leadership role in that. It isn't all about preventing things from happening. Are we going to be the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, which has development as well as conservation? Are we going to look at that as a way in which positive change can occur? We have to deal with it. Sea level rise against mandates us to look regionally. Every community can't prevent sea level rise. It takes us holding our hands together to do that. You have to do it comprehensively. How is that going to be done, I think, are some of the essential characteristics. So it's a great opportunity to be here, and the Bay presents a phenomenal opportunity for environmental restoration, for transportation, and for the kind of positive growth and change that will not contribute to the negative aspects of climate change. We do have a moderate climate. We can support more density. We can maintain our water-dependent uses on the waterfront, and we can do a heck of a lot towards restoration, towards wetlands, towards enhancing public access, and creating some of the most attractive recreational and open space opportunities in the Bay that bring people to the waterfront and make it even more exciting. We have not done that yet, and we can do a lot more to it. We have, in the past, prevented the worst from happening. Now it's time to make the best happen. Thank you.
Thanks. So that ends our first round. I think let's give a round to all the panelists for keeping on time and having very exciting things to say. That was a terrific job for the panelists. So, as I said at the beginning of the talk, one of the purposes of this is to get some feedback to the Bay Planning Coalition on to help its waterfront leadership initiative. So what I'd like to do now is maybe just give everybody on the panel, starting with Mark, going down 2 minutes, what do you see as the biggest obstacle, maybe 2 minutes each, what's the biggest obstacle to what you're trying to accomplish, and what can the Bay Planning Coalition do to help out? And I thought, Boris, you probably said what hopefully everyone will say is, who is going to be the advocate for positive change and bring people together in the Bay Area? And hopefully, people will say it's the Bay Planning Coalition. So, Mark.
Well, certainly, I know at least in two instances, the Bay Planning Coalition has been positive in terms of the things I've been working on. So, I do think that you're a very important part of this process. I did like the last comments because I think it is important to remember with BCDC that it's both conservation and development, and we can do both, okay? We do need people to come together and look at how we do positive change. I've often found things where the second we start a study, there's an instant perception that the plan is already done. And today in California, I don't know how you would do that. You certainly can't do that in the Bay Area. But we have people that the second you say, and there's a whole series of code words, but the second you say one of them, they'll all show up and they instantly feel that that there are problems. So I think if we can have the agencies that can be a positive force to bring us together, because our interests go beyond just my community. I listen to Susan at Island Energy. Well, her development at Mare Island, we provide the power for Mare Island, both electricity and gas. So I want Vallejo to be the most successful place that can be. And I want it to be a great place for people to live, for open space, and for commercial development. When I think about San Francisco, we may be a small city, but by 2015, I'll be providing the city of San Francisco with 40% of their power through Transbay Cable. Okay? Do I want San Francisco to be a success? You better believe it, because I want that cable to be maxed out on power. All those things are important, and it means the Bay, we've considered it in a lot of different ways. And just to have a meeting with this, I heard a whole bunch of different perspectives, which helped me. And it's one of those things where then you grab all the cards. And the more meetings like this you can have, the better it is to have positive communication. And that's certainly what we need.
Great, thank you.
Can I be the first one to throw out money?
Yes.
Not only does it cost a lot of money to do what we're trying to do, which is build facilities and vessels, and I can get past that one, but I think the economy is a huge challenge for us today because so much of what we're charged with is looking to do something new, looking to expand the existing transportation system at a time when our state is in crisis. Public transit all around us is in crisis. So I think I'm feeling especially challenged today as an organization that's looking to expand transit in a region that is coming up on contracting public transit. And I want a second. I want Vallejo to succeed. And San Francisco and Pittsburgh. And because, like I said earlier, I think what we're trying to do complements everything that you're trying to do. And if you're successful, there will be ridership and we'll succeed. So, you know, the partnership is huge for us. I guess I can leave it at that. Thank you.
That's good. I mean, I think that's an important point for the Bay Planning Coalition, because it says that there's a lot of synergy between interests which may not communicate in ways that they should be communicating with each other. So I think it's a good goal for the Bay Planning Coalition to foster that kind of communication and identify common goals that really have synergies between different areas.
Hand this over. I'm sorry, but I had one other thought, and I think that's just to throw out to this room and my partners here. I think that if you can help me communicate out that I think ferry transportation provides something help me differentiate ferry transit from a bus route or a you know, some other form of transportation. I think that's going to be very important for us in the regional arena here. In order for us to be able to achieve what we're trying to do in this tough time.
Thank you.
Let me reiterate the call for cash. That's always appreciated. So two things I wanted to mention. They're kind of a regional nature. We've talked about a little bit is dredging. And I think all of us who have either communities or developments along the bay, we are constantly facing the need to dredge. It's extremely expensive. We have good regulatory partners that are working with us on it, but that is kind of a never-ending challenge. The other one, and I know we all face this as well, is many of us have waterfronts that have a long, long, wonderful history. And early in our evolution, we were probably doing a lot of heavy industrial, and that's certainly true in Vallejo. We have literally millions and millions of dollars to go on cleaning up hazardous waste in order to complete our development, and the Regional Water Board has been a wonderful partner. But to the extent that we can get state and federal dollars to help a medium-sized city address these long-term problems, that would go a long ways. And I want to thank you for the power and for the ferry.
Do I push this button? Yeah, we represent, I guess, a fairly substantial private investment in the waterfront. And we think it's a pretty green investment. We're hoping to make some substantial improvements. But as a private investment, we need to make some money on it. We're proposing to bring a great deal more traffic of container traffic and commerce to the Bay region by competing effectively on a basis of price with the other ports, price and efficiency. To do that, we need to avoid burdening the system with a lot of excess tariffs and costs and fees that would prevent us from making the investments that's necessary to make our facility greener. I don't know how to express that properly, but we're going to be making an investment that's green, but it's an investment. And so we need to have the elbow room to make that investment, to make it a realistic investment, and to make a realistic return on that investment. So I guess what I need the BPC to do is to continue to be the voice of common sense that says we're going to make some investments, but they're investments, and we're going to make the world better, but it's going to take some time, and we're going to get it done. So give us some room, and we'll get it done.
Thanks, Don.
Would you like a microphone?
No.
Well, you have one anyway.
Darn.
Nice try.
First off, let me say that what I will say does not necessarily represent the views of the commission I work for. And as my wife always asks me to please understand, it doesn't represent her views either. The Bay Planning Coalition is extraordinarily effective in being an advocacy for a wide range of interests. But just in this discussion we've been having about waterfront, there are going to be times when you're going to have a particular part of the waterfront, and you're going to have this gentleman want to use it this way and another one want to use it that way. To the degree that the Bay Planning Coalition can actually engage in specific areas, specific disputes, and then come out of that with a firm conclusion on behalf of the Bay Planning Coalition that here's what should happen here. That would be extraordinarily helpful. But for the most part, I think in order to keep all of the members happy, you come out of it with something that's so general that whoever you're talking to can't figure out what the hell you're talking about. The other thing is to understand that as an advocacy organization, Bay Planning Coalition is advocating to somebody. And we've talked about there's 110 local governments in the Bay Area. There's a whole variety of state, federal, local agencies. As somebody said, the Bay Area is more Balkanized than the Balkans. But, Paul, be careful of what you wish for. Because one solution to that is, well, gee, let's get everybody together. And the problem with this whole advocacy of let's build more in the Bay Area where it makes more sense, it's going to have a lower carbon footprint, and we don't want to chase people over the hills, have them drive out into the Central Valley where they have to use a lot of energy to cool their houses and water here. It makes perfect sense to everybody intellectually. They just don't want it in the communities in which they live. Because we move places that are nice, and we want them to stay nice. So we tend to be a species that is adverse to change. And we as planners keep talking about how wonderful the world can be, but people don't trust us. They see growth as a bitter pill you have to swallow to do some good for climate change. We actually have to be building better communities. But with this broad group of people that doesn't want their neighborhoods changed, 110 local governments, if you really want to have one agency that is empowered to think on behalf of the Bay Area, one of the problems we have right now, there's no elected official anywhere in the universe who is elected to represent the Bay Area. We have counties, cities, special districts, but nobody represents the Bay Area. And if you want to have an elected czar of the Bay Area, that's one thing. But maybe to make sure the person is exempt from political influence, we get somebody that's appointed for life. And we have state employees that are like that. They're in San Quentin. You could get somebody there. So the problem is, again, as I say, the Bay Planning Coalition is very good in being a general advocate for a general perspective. It could very well be that on specific waterfront sites where you can bring your members who are at odds with each other together, sit them down, work something out, and then bring that solution forward, you'd be far more effective in advocating to this wide range of agencies and organizations and government levels that we as a species have designed to manage how we grow. Thanks.
Thank you, Travis. Paul, see if you can grab it.
Is this on? I think I have a candidate for that appointed for life position. His name's Peter Douglas. And I think maybe he can do for the Bay Area what he's done for the Coastal Commission in terms of that lifetime tenure. Speaking on behalf of Professor Glazer and myself, we both believe that Bay Planning Coalition can continue to play a very effective and important role in bringing together disparate groups and advocating for balanced uses of the Bay. And I think that for as long as I have been involved with Bay Planning Coalition, that has been the fundamental mantra, that certainly there's no appetite in the Bay Area for unfettered market forces, but there's also a need for an injection of reasonableness when we're talking about regulation of all types. And I think that Bay Planning Coalition has always done a very good job of articulating that role.
her position, and I hope that it continues to do that for another 20-plus years, and I look forward to being part of that.
I think that the question had to do with some of the obstacles that we're facing to get some of our work done, but I'll also include some of the opportunities for the Bay Planning Coalition. With a plan to protect, restore, enhance 200,000 acres, and mind you, that's with a lot of overlap. It's not 200,000 new acres. There's a lot to do with protection and then restoration. So those acres can be counted twice. But there's quite a hurdle to overcome just to get that done, particularly given the fact that we do have a lot of infrastructure that we're challenged with in order to be able to restore wetlands. And some of these wetlands, particularly in the Central Bay, are postage stamp size, where we have some large opportunities in the North Bay and the South Bay, and then even out into Sassoon in the Delta. We also have some major political hurdles. A lot of our partners are applying for permits very, very similar to what any developer would be doing. We've got restrictions on those permits about the time of year for construction because of the species that are impacted. Also because of the fact that we are in such an urbanized area, and it is the populace here that's supporting what we're doing through a lot of the bonds, there's a major access desire on the part of the people to reach the bay and to be able to see the wildlife that they're coming to view, while at the same time we have to reduce the impacts that this kind of traffic could bring to the wildlife that we're trying to protect. So we've got these major infrastructure issues that we're dealing with. And then we've also got partners that are working to protect areas that may be subject to development and at the same time subject to the potential of sea level rise. And so there may be areas that the Bay Planning Coalition could help from a policy standpoint, as Travis was talking about, to potentially identify places where it maybe infill would be better, a better use, and there may be wetland areas or adjacent uplands that it would be best to go ahead and protect the entire area. So there's a lot to wrestle with. We also are wrestling with this fact that we have competing species in certain areas as we're doing the restoration and planning designs. Our partners are working on this on a project-by-project basis, and part of what the joint venture is trying to do is to bring the biological planning, the research, and the restoration design to mesh so that the projects are integrated to reach those goals. The species don't know the difference between one project and another. What they're looking for is the best habitat. If we're creating habitat for all of one type of species, either because it's the cheapest to create or because of the fact that we are responsible for trust species, then there may be others that are species to be concerned about that will be traded off. And so it's a real balancing act through the adaptive management planning, the biological planning that's occurring now, the research that's being contributed constantly, the restoration design, and then also the reality and the construction costs. So we've got some major challenges that are also economic. The sheer cost of doing these projects in some instances determines the types of projects that we do. We've also got airports that are in the way of some of the projects, and given what happened in the Hudson River a couple of months ago, we're having to rethink how and where the types of wetlands are being placed near airports. And so consequently, there's a lot of design that needs to be taken into account. So we have a lot of challenges, and we also recognize that this is an urbanized area, and so one of our biggest challenges is reconnecting hydrologies, reestablishing ecological values while still maintaining the quality of life for the people that live here.
Well, you know, I would say that, number one, an advocacy group that, like the Bay Planning Coalition, is essential. But you have to go beyond advocacy in order to make positive change, and I would agree with that. And I think you do have to deal with the Bay on a regional scale, and that is an essential characteristic, and it has to be dealt with in a way where there is both the carrot and the stick. in order to make it happen. I think there tends to be more stick than carrot. In other words, there needs to be also a way in which, if BCDC, for example, would not only have the regulatory power, but would have a funding mechanism where you could add funding in order to achieve regional objectives, you would be much more effective, I would think, in terms of being able to respond to the kind of change that needs to happen. And if we look at agencies that have been effective, certainly they need the leadership, the broad vision that represents the region as a whole. But at the same time, you have to have both regulatory power and funding power. And I think that I know we're in economically difficult times, and someone's talked about state funding and how difficult it's been. But at the end of the day, positive change will create a kind of economy that will not be in the hardships we have today by spending a lot of the resources of our society in the wrong places and really making things less sustainable rather than more. So my, you know, hope would be that not only leadership through a group like this to be more effective, but also to apply the resources that are necessary to make positive change happen as well.
Thank you. That's a great feedback from the group. We have talked about now having questions between the panelists and then questions between the audience. So, Ellen, I don't know whether you have any questions from the audience or whether any one of the panelists has a particular burning question they'd like to ask somebody else. This was supposed to end at 3. We started at 2. We're sort of on time if we started late. Ellen, so... Okay.
Here's one for Ports America on sea level rise. That's a good one for Tom.
Okay. Anybody on the panel have a burning question for anyone else?
Not so much of a burning question, but I just can't help hearing. We are all talking about how everybody else has to understand how our perspective and our interest is really important, and it really is. And then we're looking for some way of making sure that our objectives get achieved, and we're kind of blaming it on each other. It just occurred to me, maybe what we ought to do is try an experiment. And that is, the California Home Builders Association will tell Paul, next year your salary is going to be based on how many acres of wetland are restored. And we're going to tell Beth, next year your salary is going to be based on how much cargo goes through the Port of Oakland. And we're going to you see what I'm getting at here. We all do what we do based on what we like doing and are good at. And it's very difficult for us to embrace somebody else's objectives. And I think at the end of the day, that's what we really need to do. We need to be looking at how we can individually succeed in doing what it is that we're paid to do by helping somebody else succeed in doing what it is they are paid to do.
And Travis, that's two things.
How many acres of wetlands are you going to restore, big dog?
I don't know if it's... I don't need a microphone. I don't know if it's subconscious or not, but... every time the question of housing comes up, it is the negative. Every time you speak of something that's the good, it's the wetlands or the carbon footprint reduction. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about a mindset in the Bay Area where we talk about balance, and you're just sort of admonishing sort of the group for a group thing of everyone, you know, looking out for themselves. But almost every time you say an example of who's looking out for themselves and sort of the problem that is, it's housing. And I would suggest that that's part of the problem. And it's a deep-seated and deeply held viewpoint. I would turn it around and say, I'm willing to do that next year and we'll make your salary dependent on shepherding a housing project through the approval process, getting it financed, and getting it sold at a profit here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
It's a deal.
All right. Because, no,
as my staff can tell you, I spend more of my personal time trying to increase the housing supply in the Bay Area than I do in protecting the Bay, because they do a sensational job of protecting the Bay, and the housing supply in the Bay Area is the absolute Achilles heel of our continued prosperity as a region. We are not making enough of it. We have a lot of innovative people here who create a lot of jobs, and we are not creating enough housing for them and for their children. So when I talk to my friends in the environmental community who say, well, it's not our job to deal with housing, we need to protect the environment, I say, here's the equation. More jobs than there is housing, you've got some choices here. You either bring somebody in from Flint, Michigan to run the thing so that we don't have all these innovative people here creating jobs. We continue what we're doing and exporting our housing. We produce more housing, or we begin to kill our children, because that's who's occupying these houses. So, Paul, I'd love it, especially at your salary.
And I want to take a shot at this as well. Rather than having my salary dependent upon the Port of Oakland and how much cargo goes through there, I'd rather have it be on how many jobs are created through green infrastructure. And just when we had the bond freeze that came through in December, we began calculating using the Department of Commerce calculator about how many jobs and what the economic value would be of the wetland projects that are on the books right now, those that could turn dirt in 90 days if the funding came through. And we realized that we were creating several hundred jobs out of the wetland projects that could start tomorrow. And we also calculated that we had over $94 million worth of projects on the books. And so there are ways that we can use green infrastructure and have win-win where we don't have to say it's either jobs or the environment, but we can have both.
Okie dokie. So actually, I had a thought, which is, should we be planning if all the recovery plans work for all the salmon species and we have great fisheries back, where are the fishing boats going to be in San Francisco, and where are we going to process the fish catch? And maybe we need to plan 30 years from now for having a robust fishing industry in San Francisco again. But I digress, I suppose. So a couple of questions. For Nina, there's a question about how can the WTA overcome local opposition to citing ferry. I'm from Philadelphia. I pronounce F-E-R-R-Y, F-U-R-R-Y, so you'll just have to excuse me. Ferry service in Berkeley.
Put it in Richmond.
So you want to answer that? Try to take a shot at that.
Who suggested putting it in Richmond? Well, I met with the mayor of Berkeley yesterday. We're working on it. I think there's actually a lot of support for ferry service in Berkeley, and I think there's a specific group of folks who are concerned about us impinging on their water sport activities, and we're hoping to actually work closely with them to overcome any concerns about what it is that we're planning.
So there's a specific interest. For Tom Ward, yeah. Tom, will your new port facilities be designed to accommodate sea level rise, and if so, how are you dealing with that concern?
The good news is that the Port of Oakland's wharves are all pretty far off the water. I think we've got about 15-foot clear to high tide, 12-foot clear to high tide. So we don't have an immediate concern with sea level rise to the degree that it affects the cranes that we put over the ships. Those will have to be a little bit taller, but that's just a little bit of steel. We don't see, because the port has designed some fairly high facilities already, I don't think it's an immediate and urgent problem for most of the port. Is IME still here? I guess not. We don't see it as a real big problem simply because it's already an engineered facility and it was designed with, not necessarily with this in mind, but with a fair bit of freeboard.
Okay. Now, just finish up that Travis did send two questions to me in advance in the meeting, and I'll just throw those out to the panel. Maybe we could pick one or two people. questions he asked, and I think they're good questions. Are you aware of any place around the country that has successfully dealt with competing demands on limited waterfront areas so that everyone is satisfied, so that they could be used as a model for a similar program in the Bay Area? So is there someplace we can benchmark from? And also this question, which I asked John Joy at the beginning about the approaches to dealing with these vacant low-level properties in danger of flooding by sea level rise. Anybody want to brainstorm in either one of those two questions?
Danville has done an excellent job of eliminating conflicts on its waterfront.
So you're the Danville model, Paul. Is
Livermore's program is very good as well.
I think maybe that everyone's tired, and this will be a great time. Thank you very much. It's an excellent panel. Thank you.
You guys owe me.
I'm just going to make a couple of concluding remarks and encourage you all to continue this conversation out in the Sustainability Cafe. And as I said earlier, that we really encourage you to continue the embracing each other's objectives because to the extent that you can, and I think we've already got something going with Paul Campos and Trav, which we're going to seal for the future here. But, you know, we started out talking about sustainability strategies for a changing Bay, and I think we've come and said by the end of today that we're really not talking about change. We really are talking about transformation and a major one. I think the emphasis on these recovery plans for endangered species, it's not a new concept. These recovery plans have been on a long time, but we're some of the projects that I've been involved in around the Bay, we're trying to do a better job of marrying up, I see Dick Butler smiling, marrying up these recovery plans with some of our other projects. For instance, the port port maintenance, port expansion around the Bay with marsh creation, with dredge material and recovery plans, of course, for the species as well, which get to the balancing of different habitat needs, which Beth Hunting was talking about. So we are gradually building in into our projects more of the values that we've talked about all day long and that Bay Planning continues to talk about. The promise, the potential of the Bay as a marine corridor, it's been this way for centuries, but we can do a better job, but do a better job here again of building in the universality of values. And just, you know, the fact, too, when we think more about Earth Day, we really always need to remind ourselves that we are truly interdependent on each other and for the values that we hold dear about our environment and the economy. So, and I like to just conclude, I like what Boris said. In the past, we prevented the worst from happening. In the future, we will make the positive happen with all of you as partners and leaders. And I thank you all for coming today, and we'll see you at Bay Planning events in the future. Thank you.
That was good.
That's right. We actually have the funding for the first phase, and we've just bought the property, and we're demolishing a thing to do the first phase. This is a stage, they kind of have working kind of rules. And then Paul.